It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Co-host Veronica Rickert will be back with me on Monday. Coming up, why are most visitors to national and state parks white and well-off? Our guest explores the adventure gap, why not all Americans take advantage of the country's huge network of wild spaces and efforts to change the face of wilderness adventure. First, back in September, Wisconsin Public Television producers saw the state in a whole new way from the air. The crew filmed Wisconsin's cities, bluffs, rivers, lakes, and farms from a helicopter. The result is a new special called Wisconsin from the Air. It premieres Monday, December 1st at 7 p.m. on public television stations around the state. Lori Gorman was in that helicopter. She's WPT's executive producer in production services. Lori, welcome to Central Time.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Well, my first reaction to watching, and this is just my little computer screen, was wow. So yeah. What was it like to actually be seeing the state firsthand from the sky?
Well, it's going to sound a little trite, but it actually was kind of a privilege to be able to see it this way. I mean, we've all had experiences being on an airplane and flying out of Milwaukee or Madison or another airport. But in a helicopter, you can get real up close. You can get very low. You can swoop in and hover and go around and around. And it was quite the experience.
And what was it like seeing, and you mentioned, you know, this isn't just aerial shots. You
right.
are zooming along
yes.
rivers or farm fields. What does that feel like and that view coming at you like that?
It's pretty amazing. My firsthand view was from behind the director of photography, so I always had him in front of me. But you know, I had a side window, too, that I could look out, and I could take some iPad photos and that sort of thing. So, yeah, it was a pretty amazing experience. And this is coming from someone who doesn't really like heights. And I prefer not to drive across large bridges over water. So to actually not only fly on top of them and then swoop down on them, I had my moments of things were a little unsettled, but it went well.
So where did this idea come from, to look at Wisconsin from the air?
Well, the idea of doing an aerial program has been around for a long time. I think the first show of this type was done by the public television station in the state of Washington in Seattle. And they did it and had great success with it. And lots of other stations started doing it. And I've been around Wisconsin Public Television for quite a few years. And there's always the idea has come up and then sort of faded away. But the timing on this was just right. The funding came together and the ability to do it, the personnel was available. So that's sort of what made it happen for us. And, you know, it was kind of surprising that as gorgeous as this state is, that it had not been done before.
Yeah. And I got to say, watching it, I mean, I know Wisconsin's beautiful. It has amazing things to look at. But sometimes watching, I'm like, that's my state?
Yeah.
Because I haven't seen, you know, hovering over the shore, looking in at the beach and the
right.
houses there or all the different views. Did this just change the way you look at Wisconsin?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, we've had a few screenings around the state, and I'll have people raise their hand and say, so where is the Tiffany Stone Arch Bridge? Or where are these mounds? And so I think that's pretty cool to watch it and feel like you haven't quite discovered mm-hmm. this place that you know so well, that there are still some gems out there that are out there for you to find.
So what's the range of scenes that you tried to capture in this project?
Well, as far as that goes, what we did was we solicited from folks around the station and beyond, what should we shoot?
Mm, okay.
What would you include if we're going to do this project? And from that, we created a list of over 200 sites. And we had sort of our must-haves, and then we had our nice-to-haves, if time and location allowed. And once we had contracted with the firm that was going to do the shooting for us, we put together this list and we researched the longitude and latitude and handed that over to the pilot. And he came up with a flight plan that laid out how we were going to accomplish all this in the course of 1 week.
And you really get a little of everything. I mean, urban, yep. rural, nature, the shore, lake, water, everything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to me, it was, this may be a no-brainer, but there's so much water in this state.
Yeah.
There are lakes and there are rivers and there are creeks and there are ponds. And it's just everywhere you look, which is nice to be reminded of that.
That was the thing that struck me the most, I got to say. You know, trying to pick just one thing to talk about, I'd say it would be the way water shapes the state.
Yes.
Great lakes, little lakes, and,
yep.
and the streams and rivers you mentioned.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. And then you can obviously see the way cities have grown up around water, like mm-hmm. Chippewa Falls and Milwaukee and Madison.
Yeah, and I think that I was just, you know, in a few different towns, Fort Atkinson and other places. Mm-hmm. And being in there, you kind of see, oh, yeah, the river's right there in the middle.
Right, right.
Or this town's right, you know, Minocqua's right on the lake. But to see, like, Minocqua, you mm-hmm. show there, and to see how it hugs the lake and how it's there and built around the water, you just don't get that being there on the ground.
Yeah, and it you bring up Minocqua, which reminds me of one of the moments we had, Mike Eicher. And Mike Eicher was the lead editor on this, the only editor on this. And we were in the edit room, and we had it up on a big monitor, and another producer stopped by, and the shot of Minocqua was up. And she stopped and looked at it, and she said, wow, that reminds me of when my family and I used to go up there, you know, every summer, and there's that place where we'd have dinner. And that was the exact reaction I was looking for people to watch this and be reminded mm-hmm. of these special places that we've all been to.
Yeah, a lot of the places are new to me. My moment with that was a view of one of the bluffs in Devil's Lake. Like,
yeah.
Oh, that could have been me standing
right
there. It probably wasn't that particular day. But so what was your moment, yeah, like, either when you're up in the air or watching back?
Well,
later?
You mentioned that. We were at one screening, and there was a man who claimed to be the couple on the beach
in Door
County. He said, I think that must have been us. So I let him have that for himself. That's fine.
That's great.
Yeah. But, yeah, just being up there again, like I said, it was really a privilege to be able to see the state this way.
Now, you got some moments of, I guess, serendipity. I think one time there's an eagle flying there. You couldn't have scheduled the eagle.
No, we didn't schedule the eagle. There is a man windsurfing on Lake Michigan just off Milwaukee's shore who does this incredible flip. We did not schedule that. That was serendipity. Yeah, some of those sunrises were just gorgeous. You can't plan that. There was one – oh, actually, we were shooting the state capitol on a Saturday morning because we wanted to get it with all the farmers market activity going on. And from there, we set out to shoot some other things out in the countryside. And on the way, we passed over Lake Mendota, and the university rowing team was out. So here's a great opportunity to shoot something else. So we hovered, and we were shooting them, and they stopped rowing, and we realized, well, the noise from the helicopters probably interfering with them being able to hear their commands from their leader. So we waved goodbye and went on our merry way.
Another great serendipity moment, if you remember this one, it's over a lake, and I can't remember which one, and there's the sun shimmering over it, and you kind of see the shimmering section move along. I don't know if you remember where that was, but that was one that was just like, you know, you'd pay for art like that.
Right. Well, and that comes down to the talented crew that we worked with. The camera person, the director of photography, his name was Travis McMunn, and the helicopter pilot was Nick McMahon. And those two have worked together a lot, and they've worked on some feature films and commercial work. And that was another amazing part, was to see them working together to get those shots.
Yeah. On a technical standpoint, I think when you think of filming, you've got something on a tripod or a boom or, I don't know, all your fancy technology in TV land. How much harder is it to get good stuff, you know, on a helicopter?
Well, I don't know if you had a chance to see. We have a video online that shows some of the behind the scenes, but the camera itself is located outside. It's on a rig outside the helicopter, and everything is controlled from inside. And again, the group that we went with, they have spent years creating and patenting some of these rigs that were used. So we left that technology in their hands because they're the pros at that.
Now, one thing I really liked about this was it seems like the instinct might be, let's capture Wisconsin's natural landscapes.
Mm-hmm.
You did that, but you didn't just do that. Talk about some of the Wisconsin at work, the Wisconsin man-made structures that struck you as you were flying around.
Yeah, well, we look for opportunities to capture a lot of agricultural shots. We shot this in September of 2013, which was fortuitous because that's a very active time in agriculture. There's a lot of harvesting going on, and it was great to get those shots. We also wanted, of course, to include an urban feel and get some of those iconic, say, businesses. So you'll see a quick shot of Leinkugel's and of Harley Davidson and Miller Brewer, because that's part of Wisconsin, too. And it was nice to be able to have an opportunity to include such things as Game Day at Lambeau Field Game Day at Miller Park, and of course at Camp Randall with the Badgers.
Yeah, and another one I liked, Wausau, a great view of just downtown Wausau and the environs, and the harbor in Superior, you know, with a big, you know, one of those big cargo ships, but also, you know, the smaller boats and tucked away in the harbor.
Yeah, the pilot was really taken with Superior and with those big, big structures that you talked about, the big storage bins or grain silos and the large boats. So, and that we were there just at twilight, so the light on Superior was quite quite lovely.
Now, maybe this is a terrible question to ask, but you were on this big fishing expedition for great scenery. Was there the one that got away, something you wish you'd gotten that the lighting didn't work out or the angle didn't work out or something like that?
Yeah, there were a couple of those. We had hoped to get, since it was that time of year, actual cranberry harvesting, which would have made a lovely visual. But last year, we were just – the week we shot was a little too early for that. We had also met with a pilot from the DNR to get his take on wonderful things to shoot. And one of the things that he alerted us to was an elk herd in northern Wisconsin. So the morning we were shooting in that area, we called again to get the, you know, the logistics for where they had last been sighted. And we went there, but couldn't find the elk herd. So maybe another time we'll be able to find them.
Well, and I've got to wonder now, we've got snow on the ground. Is there any thought to do a winter in Wisconsin follow-up, which I imagine would look very different but still compelling?
Yeah, that question has been asked, and there certainly are plenty of things we could shoot. Ski hills, the Birkebeiner race, ice fishing, lots and lots of stuff. So we'll have to keep that in mind. I think it'd be a great show.
Now that you're earthbound, you know, you said it changed your view, but as you're walking around, do you try to, like, I guess, reconfigure your brain to think, what would this look like from up there or hovering or moving along over there in the sky?
I don't know if I do that so much, but I do recall, like, I was coming back from Minneapolis and we took the route that comes down along the Mississippi River. And I was recalling as we were driving on the ground what it looked like as we were flying over it, certain locations like Alma and La Crosse. So it still comes back to mind.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a beautiful project. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you for having me.
Lori Gorman is an executive producer in production services at Wisconsin Public Television. Wisconsin from the Air premieres Monday, December 1st on Wisconsin Public Television. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert will be back on Monday. Coming up, it's our weekly look at news from around the state, including the latest on Wisconsin enrollments for coverage under the Affordable Care Act. First, the U.S. has a vast network of national and state parks, which many people consider one of the nation's great treasures. But according to a report by the Outdoor Foundation, a small proportion of park visitors are non-white. Considering that these outdoor spaces were created for everybody to enjoy, why are so few people of color taking advantage of this big heritage? Well, my next guest is an avid adventurer who has grappled with that question. He's got a new book out that explores the causes and possible solutions to what he calls the adventure gap. James Mills joins us in the studio. He's a freelance journalist, independent media producer. He climbs tall things, and he's the author of The Adventure Gap, Changing the Face of the Outdoors. James, thanks so much for joining us.
Rob, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So give us a little more detail. What do you mean by the adventure gap?
Well, I have been in the outdoor recreation industry for almost 25 years now, and as a person of color, I continue to see myself as one of the few people of color in the business of outdoor recreation, but also whenever I go out into the wilds of the national parks or to recreation areas or to wild and scenic spaces around the country, I'm continually one of the very few people of color that I actually see, and my anecdotal experience is affirmed by statistics that indicate that as a percentage of the population, African Americans, Hispanics, Asians, people of color in general tend to spend less time in nature than do their white counterparts.
We'll spend a lot of time talking about how to reach out to new audiences, and I'm throwing new in air quotes there, because in your book you say this isn't really so new. There are stories of people of color intimately involved with the creation of national parks and American wilderness. Why haven't we heard about these stories? Why is it important that we do?
Well, that's a really good question because, frankly, again, as someone who's been in the business for a long years, it wasn't until the year 2008 that I heard about the story of the Buffalo Soldiers and their experience in Yosemite. And very few people know that in 1903, 1905, 1906, African-American horsemen of the U.S. Cavalry were instructed by Teddy Roosevelt under the advisement of John Muir to go out and patrol the parks. And for that time period, there were actually over 400 African Americans who were intimately involved in the creation of this particular national park, as well as in Sequoia and in Yellowstone. And believe it or not, a lot of the work that they have done actually helped to create the standards that are recognized as what the National Park Service stands for today, which in 2 years will be 100 years old.
Now, when you, in your book, you talk about this, when you look at outdoor magazines, you don't see many people of color. When you think about, when you picture maybe a mountaineer in the United States, you don't picture a person of color. So what message does that send, say, to a young African-American person in a city? that they don't see that?
Well, very specifically, I mean, I've had young people tell me personally that it's not for them. Mm-hmm. You know, and that creates a paradigm of that's a huge problem. I mean, when you have young people who decide that because of their race or because of where they're from or because of their lineage, they don't think that it's something that they have a legacy to embrace. They don't have an opportunity to be able to say that this is something that it, not only is it for me, but it's part of my heritage. And when you have young people who self-identify out of becoming involved in outdoor recreation, that means that future generations will be less likely to spend time outdoors.
So I guess one big maybe bad question is, so what? What do they lose? What do we lose if that audience isn't connecting with these outdoor wilderness adventures?
Well, I mean, technically, you know, It's really not a problem per se, but if you look at the changing demographics of America, it's estimated by the year 2042, a majority of the country will be non-white. So as the population shifts to favor a non-white majority, if a majority of the population has no affinity for the outdoors, if they don't have a vested interest in spending time in nature, there's a good chance that the areas that are protected by federal legislation, by federal tax dollars, if those areas aren't apprised, they will be defunded. There will be situations where these areas that we embrace and love and enjoy, frankly, won't be protected either by legislation or by federal allocation of funds.
Well, let's dig some more into the causes of this disconnect. One you point to is low-income people. Often there's an overlap with African-American and other minority communities simply don't have the resources. How big a part of the question is that? What can we do about that?
Well, I mean, I think that socioeconomics is always brought up in this with the presumption that outdoor recreation is an expensive pastime.
Which I imagine it is. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, I'd like to think that it's not because, I mean, if you take a look at what it takes to go camping, mm-hmm. you know, relative to what it costs to go to a theme park, you know, it costs $35 to $50 to get into a theme park like Disneyland. It costs $20 to get a family of six into Yosemite or any national park in this country. For $80, you can get a national unlimited access pass for a year to the national parks. So when it comes to the economics of it, it really isn't necessarily a question of it costing too much. Now, definitely camping equipment can be expensive, but it doesn't have to be. I mean, you can get a good tent or a sleeping bag or a backpack, you know, at a general purpose retail store for relatively low money. So it's not really a question of socioeconomics so much as a matter of being able to recognize that it's something that's important to you and ultimately worth the monetary investment.
And another part of the picture is you say the legacy of segregation policies and racism. How did that contribute to this adventure gap?
And that's an area that I'm going to relegate exclusively to the area of theory. And I think that a lot of people in the academic world can attest more specifically to what I believe are some of the social problems. But, you know, when you take a look at the situation of Jim Crow laws in the mid 20s through the 1960s, where areas of this country were segregated by where people could live. Essentially, if you were a person of color in this country, you were almost required to live in a city. There was no opportunity for people of color to actually purchase homes, per se, in the suburbs. Ultimately, that makes it virtually impossible for people of color to spend more time outdoors simply because of where they are allowed to go simply because of their race.
We're going to talk about solutions to this. I want to give a little tease for that. Now, you've worked with groups who bring kids out and try to overcome this adventure gap. Can you just paint a picture of the first reaction, somebody who spent their time in a city and all of a sudden they're out climbing Denali or some other challenging mountain climb?
Well, I think it's really important that people don't start their outdoor
right,
recreation experience at a climb like Denali, which is the highest peak in North America. In fact, the group that we took on this particular expedition, many of whom didn't have advanced mountaineering experience, we actually took several smaller, less ambitious trips to smaller, less ambitious mountains all over the country. Frankly, once you take a person who's spent a majority of their time outdoors and give them an opportunity to actually spend time in nature, even if it's just a state or local park, being able to spend time away from their desk, away from their offices, away from their homes, away from their classrooms, and being able to spend time in nature is a wonderful opportunity to be able to establish a relationship with nature.
And there's a quote, I think, I'm not sure which participant it was, but said, I felt like I discovered something I'd been missing and didn't know I'd been missing. Is that a pretty common response?
You know, it really is, because I think that so many people attribute a lot of their identity to the things that are around them, specifically their homes, their cars, their computers, their cell phones, their laptops. All these devices ultimately create kind of barriers to the outdoors. And I think that once we give them the opportunity to actually spend time in nature, people, regardless of their race or ethnicity, if they are primarily in an urban environment, it's a great way to experience things that are completely different from their personal experience.
We're exploring what our guest James Mills calls the adventure gap, a gap between how people of different racial and ethnic groups use the nation's outdoor spaces. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you seen this adventure gap here in the U.S., and why? Are you not a white person, and you find yourself and your community avoiding wilderness spaces? Why do you think it came out that way? And if you're an avid outdoors person, what do you get out of it that you think everyone should have a chance to experience? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue our discussion with James Mills, author of The Adventure Gap, coming up after the news. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the adventure gap, the relatively low numbers of minority group members who take advantage of the country's vast resources for outdoor recreation, for wilderness adventure. And you can join the conversation. Have you experienced what our guest James Mills calls the adventure gap? What factors contribute to it for you? What suggestions do you have to help change it? And if you have a story, maybe you grew up in a city, about your first time encountering nature, or if you're an avid outdoors person and want to make the case that everyone should have a crack at enjoying the wilderness, call and tell us why. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. James Mills stays with us. His new book is The Adventure Gap, Changing the Face of the Outdoors. James, you do a lot of outdoor adventure, mountain climbing, among other things. What is it? What is it that we get out of it? Why do you do it, apart from because it's there?
Yeah, and I love the fact that I'm having some difficulty even coming up with an answer to that question, because I think it's different for everybody, you know. And I personally, enjoy the physical experience of being in natural spaces and being in areas that are wide open, you know, fresh air, clean water. I've recently taken up fly fishing, you know, and that's something that I really enjoy and have had a few opportunities to do in various parts of the country. And I think that is, if people would give themselves the opportunity to branch out, you know, to go outside of the norm or the online experience, I think that they'd find a variety of different exciting and very interesting activities outside.
Now, in your book, you talk about programs and organizations that try to bring that experience, so for everything from fly fishing, I think, to mountain climbing, to the audiences we're talking about, maybe to urban minority populations. Could you share some of the examples with us of groups doing this kind of work?
Well, one organization in particular is called Outdoor Connections. It's an organization in San Diego, California, and Outdoor Outreach is the name of the organization, and they do incredible work getting kids involved in sports like snowboarding and surfing. And one young man in particular who's profiled in my book, his name is Ryan Hudson. Up until the age of 14, was homeless. Had actually spent his entire young life living on the streets, and found himself in an at-risk youth a residential program, and was exposed to snowboarding. And long story short, after spending years involved in this activity, he's now a professional snowboarder for the North Face, and was actually on Denali with us during the climb last summer. And I think that, someone like him working with organizations that have exposure, mentorship, and opportunity can do anything. I mean, literally go all over the world. And one of the things that I make it a point to outline in my book is to illustrate the various stories of young people, both men and women, who have the opportunity to get that exposure, get the experience, but most importantly, adult participation and supervision from older and more experienced people around them to give them the opportunity to experience the outdoors in a positive and proactive way.
Let's get to a caller. We've got Esperanza in the line on the line in Milwaukee. Esperanza, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to comment that in the 50s, we came here from Puerto Rico, and we lived in Milwaukee, and the way we were exposed to nature and the outdoors is through the Girl Scouts, and they would take us out camping, and we got to learn about how to be self-sufficient, how to make campfires and produce meals out there and really enjoy nature. And if we didn't have that experience, I don't think now I would be able to do that with my grandchildren and my children to appreciate the outdoors as a result of that.
Esperanza, thank you so much for sharing that story. So much there that we could get into. James, let's start with the intergenerational. Once you get one generation involved, does that give you a chance to create a new picture of who goes out into the wilderness?
Absolutely. Esperanza, thank you very much for your call. And I can tell you just from my own personal experience, I was a Boy Scout and was a Cub Scout from the age of 9. And literally up until the day I graduated from high school at the age of 18, I was able to spend time and experience time outdoors throughout my entire young adult life. And what was especially interesting, though, was that my dad at the time was not an outdoorsman. However, he had the opportunity to become exposed to the outdoors through other adults in our community that helped him to help me to form the relationship with the outdoors that I enjoy today. And frankly, had it not been for those early experiences, I'm pretty sure that it would have been much later in life that I would have discovered any relationship with the outdoors. And I think it's important, especially at a very young age, to get involved and hopefully get involved with an organization like the Boy Scouts or the Girl Scouts.
Esperanza, thanks so much for sharing your experience. We'll go now to Lori with us in Green Bay. Lori, hi.
Hi. I grew up in the country, so I always enjoyed being outside and exploring out there. And I just always thought that maybe these days, instead of having sports programs, that maybe we should have something where all these kids can enjoy trips, whether it's to the city or to the country, just to get them out of their towns or their cities so that they can see that there's something else out there. And the sports really are just for, a few kids, and it's not for everybody. I think even if they had trips at certain times of the year that would, just take kids out into parks or get them out doing some of these activities like hiking and biking and canoeing or rafting, whatever, I think that would help everybody instead of it just being, the sports kids.
Lori, thanks a lot. So the schools is part of the solution here, James.
No, I agree. And actually, I participated in several varsity sports in high school, but scouting was still a part of my growing up. I think that it should be one of the many things that kids get exposed to as physical activity, regardless of whether or not they're on a team. People can go camping, they can go biking, they can go canoeing, rafting, skiing, a wide variety of different outdoor activities that they can do as a group. But I think what's really interesting is that you have a very specific, very personal relationship with the outdoors that is completely divorced from individual experiences as a group activity. So I think that if schools were to have outdoor recreation as a priority, it would be a great way to expose young people to an experience in the outdoors, as well as give them the opportunity to establish physical fitness and create a healthy lifestyle.
Lori, thanks so much for that call. You, James, quote some people in the book talking about, there are role models in the sports world for people of color, not so much in this wilderness adventure world you're talking about. And you profile a couple that I'd like to get into a little. Shelton Johnson, a ranger at Yosemite, maybe a role model himself, but he also points toward the Buffalo Soldiers we were talking about earlier.
Yeah. Shelton actually wrote the foreword to my book. And for those of you who aren't familiar with him, he was prominently featured in the Ken Burns documentary, The National Parks, America's Best Idea. And he's actually currently the only permanently stationed African-American park ranger in Yosemite Valley. And what's interesting, and he's pointed out on several conversations that I've had with him, that 100 years ago, there were actually more people of color who spent time in Yosemite than there are today. You know, and so historically, I think that there are many opportunities for us to take a look and see how people of color have specifically engaged in the outdoors, you know, going back all the way to the very beginning of our culture of outdoor recreation in this country.
Well, another story you point out that I had no idea about was a North Pole explorer.
Right. Everyone, well, actually many people have heard of Robert Perry. Commander Robert Perry made it to the North Pole in 1909. However, very few people realize that he had a silent partner, an African-American man by the name of Matthew Henson, who was right alongside Perry all the way up to the North Pole. And Perry himself said, had it not been for Henson, I never would have made it to the pole. Now, what's especially interesting about his story is that Henson trained the dogs. He built the sleds. He spoke native Inuit, and he was the single most experienced person on the expedition, including Perry. However, when it came time to share the accolades for this acknowledgement, Henson was literally left out of the history books, and it wasn't until Dwight Eisenhower recognized Henson's contributions to the discovery of the North Pole in 1953. And even the National Geographic Society that sponsored this expedition didn't acknowledge Henson's participation in this until the year 2000. You know, so unfortunately, a lot of this history has been hidden, and a lot of it has been you know, kept away from people who can definitely benefit from it today.
Back to our callers now with Bill on the line in Madison. Bill, hi.
Hello. Good to be here.
Can you hear me?
Yep, go for it.
Well, I just wanted to mention, in connection with the conversation you're having, a recent article in the Los Angeles Times discusses several critics. One is a guy named John Christensen at UCLA, who were saying that a basic problem for our environmental practice traces back to John Muir. He's arguing that John Muir's idea of nature and how to relate to it was essentially kind of elitist. Not that it's expensive to get into a national park, but that it takes a lot of time and travel to get there, and that it has appealed to a kind of well-off class of mostly white people. And also that Muir's thinking about nature reflected a religious sensibility that is kind of Calvinist in its foundations and is not perhaps consistent with those of, for example, Hispanics, who come from a very different kind of religious sensibility.
Bill, thanks for the call. So maybe some fundamental differences in the way we originally thought of wilderness in this country.
Bill, that's a really, really good point. And it's one of those areas that I think is at the core of the problem. You know, when we start talking about the adventure gap, I mean, that's really essentially how it ultimately has the ability to be created. I mean, because, and actually you mentioned Hispanics, and when you think about how adventure or how outdoor recreation is codified, if you take a look at most national parks, campsite capacity is six people. Anything bigger than six people is considered a group, and you're required to have a completely separate permit for six people or more. Frankly, Hispanics have a tendency of spending time in nature in large groups. I don't think I've ever seen a group of Hispanic people in the outdoors in groups of fewer than 10. They bring the entire family along. It's a communal experience. You know, so when the National Park Service is essentially telling them that your group is different than other people in terms of how they recreate with nature, that runs afoul of their interest in being able to spend time outdoors. And I think ultimately the same thing is true of most people who recreate differently. People look at recreation in the outdoors as a solitary activity, something that should be self-reflective and alone. But there are different ways of spending time in nature, and large groups is definitely one of them.
Well, James, we'll leave it there for now. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great. Thank you very much for having me, Rob.
That's James Mills. His new book is The Adventure Gap, Changing the Face of the Outdoors. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll take a look at how Wisconsin responded to the decision out of Ferguson this week not to indict Officer Darren Wilson for killing Michael Brown. We'll talk to a couple of organizers of rallies in Milwaukee and Madison. First, it's time for a holiday weekend edition of our weekly check-in on the news from around the state. WPR News Director Michael Leland joins us now. Michael, welcome back, and happy day after Thanksgiving to you.
Happy Black Friday to you.
Well, the biggest news nationally this week, the grand jury decision to not indict a police officer in Ferguson, Missouri, echoes here in Wisconsin. What's been some of the reaction here in the state?
Yeah, there have been a number of protests, nothing certainly on the level of what we've seen this week in Missouri, but there have been a few protests that are highlighting things sort of related to what happened in Ferguson. In Milwaukee, there were a couple of protests this week focusing attention on a police shooting of a mentally ill man in a downtown park this past spring. Chuck Quirnbach reported that on Tuesday evening, about 150 people gathered, including Maria Hamilton. Her son, Dontre, was the man that police shot to death last April. She's calling on Milwaukee County's DA to file criminal charges against the officer who killed Dontre. That officer was fired last month for not following proper protocol and how he approached the situation with Hamilton.
And we'll cover that a little more on Central Time on Monday. How about outside of Milwaukee as far as protests and reactions went?
Yeah, also a Tuesday in Madison, about 250 people were marching downtown. They were focusing their attention mainly on the county's consideration of a new county jail. The protesters were saying there are already too many African Americans in jails and prisons, and they're demanding that no new jail be built in Dane County. They're also calling for more to be done to address disparities between whites and African Americans when it comes to things like education, income, and access to services.
And then anything going on outside of our two biggest cities in the state?
Yeah, over at UW-La Crosse, a number of people took part in a march also. Again, on Tuesday, they marched from the UW campus to the La Crosse police station. Maureen McCollum followed that protest march. She said most of the demonstrators appeared to be college students. Some of them said that people need to stand up to social inequalities. Others were sharing their own stories of discrimination.
Okay, a story I'm sure we'll both be following
Absolutely.
Out in the weeks to come. And speaking of stories we're going to be watching for a while, the state budget, of course, a big part of at least the first half of next year. That's the marquee big-ticket item for
exactly.
a state legislature.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing requests from state agencies. The one that seems to be getting the most attention so far comes from the Department of Transportation.
Right. Department of Transportation is proposing increases in taxes and fees by about $750 million. In the next two-year budget cycle. It's not going over very well in some circles. The department says it needs these increases to help fill a projected shortfall in the state's transportation budget. It would include a tax on new vehicle purchases and a higher gasoline tax.
So who is responding to this budget? Who's not happy about what they're hearing?
Largely business groups. Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce has lined up against the proposal. National Federation of Independent Businesses, as well as the Wisconsin Auto and Truck Dealers Association. They're saying it's clear the state needs more money for transportation, but higher taxes and fees may not be the best way to get it. Of course, there are people who support it. They include local governments and the road building lobby.
Now, there's a particular bit about hybrid cars, I understand.
Yeah, this is a report we get from Chuck Quirnbach this week that hybrid car dealers and people who own the cars don't like this proposal either because it would call for a $50 annual fee on gas, electric hybrids, and electric vehicles. Of course, these cars get much better gas mileage, or mileage rather, than a lot of gas or diesel-powered vehicles. So, in effect, their owners are paying less in fuel taxes.
This is not coming from the governor directly. This is the executive branch, but it's the Department of Transportation. Have we heard from the governor himself on this proposal so far?
Not a lot. He has said, not said a lot specifically about the proposal, although he has pointed out that significant changes are likely before he creates his proposed budget and introduces it this winter and also before the legislature approves a final budget. So a long way to go on this.
A lot of room for lobbying, a lot of room for potential changes there.
Exactly.
Well, we are seeing, we're in the midst now, right, of another open enrollment period for the Affordable Care Act. Some call it Obamacare. What is it looking like this year, especially as compared to the first go-round?
Well, that began on Saturday, right there. And you might remember that last year enrollment got off to a real rocky start. The healthcare.gov website that the federal government runs where people can go and look at plans available to them and buy coverage was not working well. It was overwhelmed by the number of people who tried to sign on. That's not happening this year. Glitches are far fewer. Wisconsin, of course, is one of the states where if you want to sign up for care under the Affordable Care Act, you go to the healthcare.gov site. The one thing that is a concern this year is that people who don't have coverage or need to change their coverage might miss the enrollment window. It's only open until February 15th. That's a little bit less than last year. And people who want their coverage to begin with the new year have to enroll or change change their plans by December 15th, so barely 3 weeks away.
And I know in the last enrollment period, there were some efforts to get the word out about who's eligible, how they sign up, when they need to do it by. Are we seeing any effort like that this time around?
Yeah, a few dozen organizations, a lot of the same ones who were involved last time. They're trying to raise awareness of the open enrollment period. There have been some public pushes, especially in Madison and Milwaukee, reminding people who bought health plans through the website last year that they should look and see what's available for the next year, because some plans have changed a bit. Some of them are more expensive. Federal subsidies have changed. And also the government's fine for not having health insurance is going to be higher next year than it is right now. Basically, that fine is more than tripling to about $325. Again, that depends on the person's income.
Do we have a sense on how many people got involved in the program, signed up last time around?
140,000 roughly in Wisconsin got insurance through the site last year. It's not clear how many are going to renew or sign up for insurance this time around, but again, they have until February 15th to do it.
All right. Well, some more numbers to watch, numbers that haven't been making me happy so far, I'll be honest, are weather here in Wisconsin. My perception, I think the facts probably back me up, is that this has been a cold month.
As usual, your perception is accurate, Rob. You're not imagining it. This November has been colder than average, colder than most of them. National Weather Service says even with the warm-up we're expecting this weekend, this is going to end up among the 20 coldest Novembers for Wisconsin since they started keeping records more than 100 years ago.
Right. And what was it last week? Right? That was cold.
Very, very cold. Last week, the highs were averaging about 15 degrees below normal. And, of course, it did get cold this week, Wednesday night and Thursday morning. Some records were set. Rhinelander had a record low of minus 11 yesterday. Antigo was 13 below. So the cold continues. But again, this is just the way it's going this month.
All right. That's the cold side of our premature winter here. How about the snowfall side of things?
Yeah, it has been higher than normal. The state is pretty much under snow, except for far southeast Wisconsin. And it's been falling at a greater rate than it has in past years. Madison and La Crosse have gotten about 8 inches of snow so far this season. Normal would be about 3.5 inches by this time. Wausau is already up to about 20 inches this season, where the normal should be about 7 by this time. Some areas closer to Michigan's UP, maybe you've seen the pictures on Facebook and other places, they're measuring snow in feet. Northwest Wisconsin is the one part that is close to normal. Most of that region has gotten about 15 inches, according to the National Weather Service, which is about normal for this point in the season.
And that's plenty for them.
That is plenty. And more to come. Of course, there were some areas, even in the northwestern part of the state, Washburn, Burnett, Bayfield, Ashland counties, where they've gotten more than 20, 25 inches of snow. So, winter's off to an early start, and doesn't necessarily mean that the rest of the winter is going to be like this, but it's in November to remember.
The weather is kind of news right now. What are we looking at this weekend?
It's going to warm up a bit. 30s and 40s this weekend, so there will be some melting most likely, and then the colder air returns next week.
We've talked some on the show about whether people like winter in Wisconsin. We've definitely had a split down the middle. Some people love it. Some people hate it. Some people are worried about another October to April winter. Do you appreciate our winter months, Michael?
I was out cross-country skiing in the Arboretum here in Madison yesterday. It felt like Christmas morning to me.
That's great. I've got to start doing stuff like that to up my appreciation for the season. Michael, thanks as always.
Happy to be here.
That was WPR News Director Michael Leland joining us for our weekly news roundup.